Good evening, everyone. The second time I went to Asia to practice there, good part of that time I was together with a friend, a woman. And even though we were very good friends, practicing the same monastery, because in Asia they often segregate the sexes in the monasteries, I mostly didn't see her for the 8 months I was in one monastery. And we were practicing, both of us, quite intensely, the meditation practice. And for me, it went quite wonderful. I had a wonderful time with the practice. And for her, it was quite difficult. And it actually got progressively more difficult as the practice went along. And probably she should have stopped her practice and left Burma pretty early on, but the teacher didn't have any sense of how to understand the psychology of Westerners, and some of his instructions to her just made it worse. And she became, for a while, she became somewhat psychologically disturbed from the experience, and eventually came back to America, and ended up going in very intensive psychotherapy for a number of years, and that helped kind of get her over that hump. And but when she first came back to this country, she went to live at Green Gulch Zen Center, because she really liked Zen practice a lot, and she really liked one of the Zen teachers there and wanted to be near him. And so she had these very great difficulties, psychological difficulties, and it was actually had become very hard for her to meditate because of the experience in Burma. And so her Zen teacher there, Green Gulch, gave her the practice of generosity. Just be generous. That's all you have to do. That's your only practice. So she practiced generosity. And she found it very powerful. And the teacher reassured her that it was very, very powerful and as significant as anything else in Buddhism. And as it is, generosity is considered to be one of those virtues and practices in Buddhism that is foundational to the whole enterprise of Buddhist practice. Many Westerners come to the Buddhism often through reading, because of the philosophy of Buddhism, sometimes through the meditation practice. But the traditional doorway to Buddhism in Asia, in Southeast Asia, and teachings of the Buddha, the way he described kind of a gradual entry into the Dharma, was through the door of generosity. There's a lovely little Zen story where a monk goes to the Zen teacher and asks, what's the gate of Zen? And the Zen teacher says, generosity. One of the reasons I like this story so much is the story, as at least was translated into English, whether you use the word gate, it said, it doesn't say whether it's the gate in or the gate out. And I suspect it's both. A good number of years ago, I read a study. Actually, it was a book on called The Gift by Lewis Hyde. It was the book, The Gift, was a great book. You should read it. I recommend it. It was a bestseller at the San Francisco Zen Center. And it was a man, I don't remember exactly his background, but I think he was interested in art more than he was interested in generosity. But somehow art and generosity were so closely intertwined in his mind that he ended up half of his book talking about generosity, and he went and read anthropological treatises on generosity and gift giving in different cultures and mythology of gift giving. And I think it's in that book he talks about an anthropologist who is studying gift giving in South Pacific. And there was a custom of people giving gifts down current from one island to the next. So he followed the currents. He followed the gift pattern of gift giving from one island to the next. And it means, I mean, if you follow the current, you don't give it back to the people who gave it to you before, right? But so he followed it, and it turned out the current made a big circle. And he came back. And and then I once read a story. It's supposed to be from Kashmir, of two women who were going to practice what was their religious obligation to practice generosity and giving, and they decided how they'd accomplish this duty of theirs was they would give to each other, and that way they would never be less of anything. They just had this back and forth, and as a result, when they died, they were both reborn as poisoned wells from which no one could drink. And so on one hand, we have the story of the South Pacific, you know, where it goes in a big circle where you just kind of, you give away and it's not an exchange, but somehow it comes back. And then you have this little story of these women who just give back and forth. And then in Lewis Hyde's book, he also talks about, I think it was New Zealand, study there of the Maori. I believe this is what it was. But where people would go into the forest or the jungles in order to hunt and gather whatever they gathered in the jungle. The forests were a very important part of the economy, I suppose, in the traditional society. And in return for that, they would give some of their bounty to the priests. And the priests would take some of that and give it back to the forest. And the studies then went on to say this was very important, that it was three-way exchange. Because if it was simply a two-way exchange, that they're taking from the forest and they give something back, then it's kind of self-serving. Or it could be seen that way, or it could be felt that way. But because you're giving it to a third, you know, a third entity, you're not giving directly back to what supports you, that it's somehow a greater expression of generosity, of gratitude in that exchange. Part of the reason I want to talk about generosity is certainly that it's the season of generosity for many people. And it's interesting that the gift-giving custom of Christmas is relatively new. It's only about 3 centuries old, apparently. And it was somewhat reluctantly accepted by the Christian clergy, because there had been gift-giving customs on the New Year's. They were somewhat not so Christian. And there were gift-giving customs on solstice also, which was not so particularly Christian. And somehow, you know, things got kind of confused or intertwined or co-opted or something. It's a relatively new tradition. But there's a tradition of gift-giving that's described. I read one account of from the 4th century Rome, where someone wrote, at New Year's, there's a frenzy of gift-buying. Everybody's out and about town buying gifts. Sounds just like today. But I also thought about giving this little talk about generosity because I was at Spirit Rock just teaching until yesterday, a short retreat with a teacher named Robert Hall. And at the end of the retreat, it's customary to give what's called a Dana talk. One of the teachers will give a little talk about generosity. And he gave the talk. And he, as part of the talk, he said, you know, I first was introduced to this practice when I first met Joseph Goldstein and Jack Kornfield and Cheryl Salzberg in 1974. And they were, Jack and Joseph were about 30, he said, and Sharon was even younger, quite a bit younger, I think. And they were fresh from Asia. Actually, Joseph had just come from Asia, and his back was out. And somehow they had a mutual acquaintance who said, oh, you should go see Robert. He's a doctor. And so that's how he went to see Robert for his bad back. And they became friends. And so he said, I fell in love with these young people because they were so starry-eyed and so idealistic. And so naive. And they were completely on a mission to bring the Dharma to the West. They didn't know how to do it. They didn't know anything except this is what they were going to do. They had no money. They had no supporters particularly, but this is what they were kind of completely dedicated to doing. And in addition, they dedicated themselves to do it freely, to not charge for the teachings, and just see how that worked out. And he thought that was, you know, amazingly naive and idealistic and starry-eyed. But and they said, you know, and they didn't have any money at all. And in between teaching retreats, they'd come and stay in my living room, the living room floor. And my kids would say, "Oh, here come the Buddhists." And I was so inspired by that, or kind of gladdened or inspired by that story, that it was a story about kind of the origin, of the particular tradition that we're part of here at the center, the Insight Meditation tradition that includes Spirit Rock and IMS in Massachusetts and many different sitting groups and teachers all over the country. That it all started, in a sense, you could say, and these young people coming back from Asia and staying in Robert's living room floor. And now we have all these big centers all over the country from these kids who had no money when they arrived. So they dedicated themselves to this process, to continue the spirit of generosity that the Buddhist tradition had lived in for so many years. The Buddhist monk's bowl, the big open top, is supposed to be in part symbolic of the open-handed, open-minded kind of approach to the Dharma. Just you go off and offer the practice, you practice yourself, and then you you have this big bowl, and if people want to put support in there, they put their support in. A monastic is not supposed to ask for support. A monastic is not supposed to actually say thank you, because it's not supposed to be an exchange. It's supposed to be if the people who want to support the monk or nun want to do it kind of out of just the pure goodness of their heart, then they see that big open gaping bowl and they put things in. And this the tradition of generosity is quite strong in countries like Thailand and Burma, and in part comes from the Buddhist culture, where generosity is understood to be really a foundation of the whole Buddhist enterprise. One of the reasons to go to Southeast Asia, to these countries, is to appreciate the tremendous generosity of the Buddhist culture. And I was amazingly inspired by it when I was there. Sometimes I was a little bit troubled by it, because there was phenomenally poor people who would come to me, when I was a monk there, and offer me a little bit of money or a little bit of something. And I felt, I grew up in a privileged life here in the West, but it would have been horrible for me not to have accepted it either, because there was such deep faith and such deep devotion to the Dharma. They weren't doing it; they weren't giving money to me. What they're doing, I was wearing the monastic robes. They were giving it to the monastic order, in a sense, to Buddhism, to help support and sustain it. And I remember feeling, In a very healthy way, I want to use the word obligated. In a healthy way, obligated to give my to practice the best I could because of those acts of generosity. I said, I have an obligation here to really make an effort. And it was quite inspiring in Burma to be there. And I felt, in a sense, I was a guest of the country. Once I came to the meditation monastery there, any basic need that I needed to have taken care of was provided for freely. No one ever asked me for money there. I lived in the monastery for eight months. No one ever asked for anything from me at all. But they were always ready to give to me. And I remember at one point my cavity fell out. And I was just sitting, minding my own business in meditation. Quietly, just sitting there. You can imagine, right? And then suddenly, so I went to the med teacher, and he said, I said, my cavity fell out. And he said, oh, okay. And next day, I think it was, a dentist came from the dental college in order to look at my tooth, to the monastery. And other people, Westerners, that got sick, and doctors would come to the monastery to take care of us. And it was, you know, Burma is a very poor country. There's a story, I don't know if it's a true story, from the English times, when the English were in Burma, of an Englishman wandering into a Burmese house, thinking it was a restaurant, and not knowing that it was a restaurant until he asked for the bill. Not realizing it wasn't a restaurant until he asked for a bill. And he said, oh. People just very happily served him. And I don't know if it's a true story, but it's really phenomenal, the generosity. One of the very early experiences of this in Thailand for me was I showed up at a monastery there and said, I'm here. I didn't know anything about meditation in Thailand or Vipassana. I just knew I wanted to meditate. And said, I came to the first meditation monastery I could find and said, here I am, what do I do? And they said, oh, you go over to that little cabin there on the edge of the swamps. And it's a teeny little kind of, you know, I don't know, 6x6, a really small little cabin, little hut. And a kuti it was called. And you just go there and sit. This is the schedule. You do this, you know, sit and walk and sit and walk. And then tomorrow you come back and talk to me. And so meditating by myself. And so I did this for about 10 weeks. But at some point during that time, so I was kind of on the edge of the swamp, and there was this long kind of plank, series of planks from the dry part of land across, it wasn't really wet, but it kind of across the swamp, I guess, to the steps that went up to this little cabin I had that was on stilts because it was in the swamp. And there was a long series of planks going across. And so I would get up in the morning. So I was a lay person there. And so I would just sit and walk and sit and walk and do my practice. And then at mealtime, which was basically once a day, the main meal was at 10:30, I think, or 11 in the morning, and no food in the afternoon. I would go to where the monks all had their food. And the monks, early in the morning, at dawn, would go out into the town, to the village, and they would go for their alms round, and they would collect food. And they'd collect a lot more than they individually needed. And they often come back with their bowls full and bags, plastic bags full of food. And they deliver it to the monastery kitchen. And the monastery kitchen would prepare it all and then serve it up this 10:30, 11 meal for everybody who lived in the monastery, whether they were monks or not. And so I wouldn't go out for the morning alms round. I would just sit and walk and sit and walk. And but one morning, I was sitting in my cabin, and I ended my session of sitting, and I got up and I opened my door. And just as I opened my door, I looked up and there were some fruit and some cookies on the top of the steps in the little porch. And I looked then up from there and I saw, about 30 feet away on those planks going away, I saw this monk walking away. And I kind of assumed that he was the one who put it there, those things. But what struck me, you know, it was very nice. I was very appreciative of the little gift. But what struck me was that he had put it there and he had walked away in such a way that for as far as he knew, I would never know who put it there. A secret act of kindness, of generosity. And that's, you know, it kind of struck me. He wasn't even expecting any thank you or even any recognition that he was being generous. He was doing a kind thing to me. It was really, really impressed me. It reminds me of another early impression like that. Years earlier than that, when I was a Zen student, a new Zen student, I was working at the Tassajara Bakery. Anybody been there? Mm-hmm. And so I was working there. I was working in the back. And I drove the manager crazy because one of the managers, because I had really long hair and a long beard, and I didn't want to wear this fishnet thing, and so, and I was supposed to be mixing all the ingredients. but anyway, that's not the story. The story is, one day I was up in the office, and one of the managers had gotten this letter from some community group that was asking for donations for some good community cause nearby. And he handed me the letter. And I don't think he asked me what should I do, but he just handed me the letter, I read it. And then he took it back, and he proceeded to write a check for, I think, $50 or $100. And I was kind of flabbergasted. Why would he do that? You know, it says something about me. But, you know, and that was a little, you know, just education to me. Oh, generosity. Here was some, here was someone I felt who had no obligation, in my sense, no obligation. Maybe he thought as manager of a business in town, he had an obligation to serve the community. But in my young mind, I kind of assumed that he had no obligation to give. And here was someone out of no obligation, just offering to give. It wasn't his money either. But that I only realized many years later. It was just, it was so inspiring for me. So there are a lot of teachings in Buddhism about generosity. There are teachings, for example, on who to give to. And I think this is a very interesting list. And it's not how it's often practiced in Asia, but the classic list is you first give to your family and friends, your immediate family. And then you give to the poor and the destitute. And then the third list, if you understand this list to be kind of progressive, I suppose, I don't know if you have to, but then the third list is you give to the Sangha, to the Buddhist community, to the monastic community, to the Buddhist community. I like to think of it that way, as progressive, because one of the movements of Buddhist spirituality is take the relationship that we have with people we're closest to, the love, the generosity, and all that, and not deny it, but then universalize it, spread it beyond that particular family, your particular tribe, your particular whatever. Universalize it. Then there are teachings on how to give, and certainly with respect and all these things. But one of the most amazing things is the Buddha said, "Don't give. You should a donor should not give unless the donor's joy is greater than the receiver." What about that for a bottom line? Don't bother. Unless you have, you know, it brings you greater joy. And I remember many years ago meeting a person who said that in situations where giving is obligatory versus situations where giving is not, and she gives freely, she feels more joy when it's freely given. So obligatory, it's still giving, it's kind of like a suggested donation or something, but it's kind of expected. What she misses out on is a sense of joy that's there when it's kind of freely given. And I love this idea. You know, don't give unless it brings you a lot of joy. However, there's another reason to give. And that is to practice generosity as a practice. So it can be done as a virtue, as, you know, inspiration of your heart to be generous in different situations. But it can also be a practice that you do. Something you engage in, not because you want to do it. Maybe you hate it. But because as a practice, it's something you're trying to cultivate or something you're using for various pragmatic purposes. And the two that I could think of as being very helpful, the purposes, one is to establish yourself in relationship to other people. If you're doing it as a Buddhist practice, I think it's very important to understand Buddhist spirituality as occurring in relationship to the community around you, some way or other. A lot of people come to Buddhism through meditation, which is very can be seen as very self. I don't like the word use the word self-centered right now because it's so isn't just negative connotations, but it's so inwardly focused. But in that, the traditional path begins with generosity. Before you do meditation, you're establishing healthy relationships with your community around you as part of your Buddhist practice, and then you meditate. So part of the reason to practice generosity is to help create a healthy sense of connectedness to the people around you. So you have a healthy connectedness. You have a sense of... So you give in such a way you feel their humanity, feel your interconnectedness, or feel something that comes from you in relationship to others. Another reason to give is to see how you grasp, how tight you are, how you're holding back, how you're afraid. And there's a lot of things that come into play if you're going to if you go out and say, okay, I'm going to start being generous today. I'm going to carry a $20 bill with me. And the first, and I'm going to, sometime during the day, I'm going to give this money, give it away to someone I don't know. Fascinating what will go on in your mind. And you probably learned things about yourself you probably wouldn't have learned it if you hadn't done that as an exercise. So it's a path of self-learning to practice generosity. And perhaps one of the things we can learn is to begin relaxing our fear or relaxing the grasping, which is very important for people practicing mindfulness, because the goal of mindfulness practice ultimately is to find a way, a healthy way, a wise way of living in the world where we don't grasp. And if generosity and grasping are closely related to each other, the practice of generosity supports the mindfulness practice. And I believe that people who practice mindfulness a lot will become more generous, because the tendency to grasp and hold and be tight about things begins to soften. But it might be a very difficult process of dealing with fear and insecurity and all kinds of important issues in that process. So generosity can be just a natural inspiration, or it can be a practice that people occasionally will take on as an exercise. What to give? And certainly you can give material things, money and goods, but you can also give kindness. You can give a smile. You can give a kind word. You can give your time. You can give your energy, your strength to others. You can give the Dharma, which is considered a very important gift to give. But you can also give justice. We have, in the bottom, we have a fundraising letter we sent out right this year, and then some people made donations, and then we sent a fundraising letter back, a thank you letter back. In the bottom of the thank you letter, it says something like, a gift of the Dharma is... You remember, Steve, what it says? The gift of the Dharma.
I just got my letter today.
The gift of the Dharma is the highest gift. Someone get a letter that says the gift at the bottom, huh? Something like that, right? And we usually understand that to be the gift of the teachings. But the word Dharma has much wider connotations in Pali. And it means that also. But it also means justice. And so the gift of justice, giving the gift of justice to others. Another gift is the gift of fearlessness. And this is considered one of the highest gifts to give in Buddhism. The gift of fearlessness, that you give yourself as someone who people don't have to be afraid of. Or you give people your peace. Maybe the two are very closely related. That you go into an environment and people have no reason to be afraid of you. They feel at peace with you. The gift of fearlessness. Another one to give is forgiveness, which has the word give in it, right? Something we give our forgiveness. And that's a great thing to do. It can be a whole practice, a difficult practice, and very self-revealing practice to give forgiveness. But to not be tight and hold back on the generosity, and that's that form of generosity also. I love it that in the Jewish tradition they have this wonderful thing called, they do the atonement thing they do once a year. What is it called?
Yom Kippur.
Yom Kippur, yeah, thank you, Yom Kippur. I think it's lovely, custom. And there was one person in our Sangha who's Jewish, and he said to me one day, he practices Yom Kippur and he likes it a lot, and he said something like, but in Buddhism we practice it every day, Yom Kippur. I don't know if all Buddhists do that, but I thought it was a very nice ideal to live up to. We don't wait until the end of the year. But to practice forgiveness. In other words, what that means is not to hold a grudge. Right? Be generous with your grudges. And then there's something else, which is to give your attention, which is an expression we have in English, to give our attention. Please, can you give your attention here? I give my attention to the breath. And as I've said maybe often enough, one of the interesting things I've learned as a meditation teacher, where I talk with people about their spiritual practice, especially on retreats, is sooner or later, for some people, we end up talking about their childhood. Not because I'm a therapist, but somehow something happened in their childhood which has made them stuck in their meditation in the present. And so somehow it comes out in the discussion. And one of the things I've learned is that one of the great sources of pain, of suffering, is for young children not to have been seen. And not to have been seen and love for a young child are basically or seemingly synonymous. So to give attention can be seen almost synonymously as to give love. Just simply to give that kind of respectful attention to someone else, to see them and be with them. To give attention. There's all these great words in English on giving. I love the word giving up. Only because I finally realized what it means. The source of the word giving up means to offer up. That's why you give up. You offer it up to, I guess, the altar or something. And how many of us give up that kind of spirit? I give up. But maybe next time you have to give up, maybe think of it as an act of generosity. And we do that a little bit. We have the expression like on the freeway, right? We give way. You know, you get home and you say, oh, I gave way to that. Oh, good. but you give way, Be generous. It's a great virtue, generosity. And there's so many ways of doing it. Anybody can do it. The Zen master Dogen said something like, to paraphrase him very loosely, you can even give the mountain back to itself. You can even give, you give something back to itself. You give your friend back to your friend. You let someone be who they are. This kind of act of generosity that kind of somehow doesn't just leave something alone, but in leaving it alone, allows it to be itself, offers it, respects it as it actually is. So everybody can practice generosity. It cultivates a beautiful heart to do it. It cultivates mindfulness. It cultivates wisdom to practice generosity. It cultivates self-understanding. It cultivates healthy connectedness with other people. There's so much goodness that comes from generosity. The Buddha once said, if you understood the benefits of generosity, you would never go one meal without offering some of it to someone else, offering some of it up. So the practice of generosity. So I hope that you'll consider all this, and I hope that you'll reflect on this theme of generosity. And those of you who have been engaged now for some time with the practice of mindfulness have already understood it. But if not, or even if you understood it to a great degree already, I'd encourage you to spend some further time reflecting on it and studying it and understanding it. Perhaps one day someone will wander into one of our homes, a stranger. And when they ask for the bill, we'll say, oh, this is not a restaurant. You are my guest. Go in peace. So, thank you. We have a few minutes. If someone would like to comment or ask questions or give a wonderful testimonial about generosity.
I mean,
yes.
Regardless of the type of generosity, I realize you mentioned there are many different kinds of it, whether it is material giving or kindness or whatever the list that you mentioned. What if your generosity is misinterpreted by the receiver of it?
Well, that can certainly happen. So what happens if your generosity is misunderstood by the receiver? I like to kind of separate out two different things here. One is the great value of that generosity for yourself. So, and what you get in exchange, you get in return, should be incidental to the fact that the value it has for you, the inspiration it has for you. So if a person doesn't understand it very well, or is angry, or is kind of ungrateful, or you know, it doesn't really matter, because it was an act, you know, it doesn't really matter so much, because you did it really for yourself, in a kind of way. Your joy was greater than the giver. And we have to look very carefully at, are we giving out of a sense of obligation? Are we giving out of a sense of exchange? Are we expecting something in return? A lot of gift giving involves an exchange of some sort or other, an expectation of an exchange. And where there's an expectation, sometimes it's not unhealthy. It's just kind of how our culture is built, to have an exchange, right? I mean, if you're into Christmas, for example, and you show up at your family's house, you know, and all the family's gathered, and you just show up and everybody gives you a present, and you kind of just sit there picking your teeth, and you know, whatever, and you don't have anything in return, it feels kind of odd. You know, it seems somehow the flow should be in both directions, I think, sometimes. But the idea of generosity in Buddhism is dana. Dana is that it's non-obligatory and with no expectation of any exchange, anything in return. Now, what happens if... But I haven't answered your question at all. So what happens if someone is misunderstood? I guess there's so many different situations where it could be different ways it can be misunderstood. It's difficult to give a simple answer. This is where maybe it takes developing street smarts. You have to, you know, you have to have good common sense and understand yourself what to say. And sometimes it helps if you explain to the person your good intentions. This is your intentions, what your intentions were in giving. I don't know. Yeah, can you say something more specific?
One that pops to mind is, like, for example, if you are kind to people, or if you smile.
If you're what?
I mean, this may not be a good example, but maybe like the example of being generous with kindness or your smile, for example, depending on how paranoid someone is, they may misinterpret it as, who knows,
right?
Any number of...
Yes, it's true. They might.
Any number of ways.
They might.
Because there are paranoid people out there.
There are.
Untrusting people, and depending on the level of the distrust or paranoia they may or may not have, they may...
Yeah, so you have to be discerning. These kind of teachings on generosity is not an excuse to give up your discernment, you know, to do it kind of naively. But also, if one realizes one's limitations about and where one's afraid, one can certainly begin looking at that place of fear. And not just take it for granted, or not to accept it kind of unthinkingly, but look where the limits of that fear is and what's actually going on there, and talk to other people and see if you can develop some street smarts. So maybe there's some person who is maybe not so useful to smile to this person in a dark alley, but perhaps you wait until, you know, a different situation where, you know, you're surrounded by your friends, you know, your gang, or something. I don't, that's a silly example, but. I see Steve wants to say something. Help.
At the Zen Center of Los Angeles years ago, they had a yearly fundraiser, and they sent out a letter. And at the bottom of the letter, it said, let the giver be thankful. And there's a whole relationship between generosity and gratitude. The Buddha talks about it a lot. And the feeling of abundance. The person that has generosity really starts with yourself, looking at yourself, being generous with yourself, making sure you eat right, sleep right. That's being generous to yourself. But cultivating a sense of abundance, when you feel abundance, generosity naturally flows.
Yeah. Many years ago, I remember I was offered to drive a friend to the airport. And she said, no, you don't have to do that. But I knew it was hard for her to get to the airport. And I kind of say, yeah, I'd like to do it. You know, I really like, you're my friend, and it's easy for me to do. No, I don't want to bother you. And it went on back and forth for a little bit. And then after a while, I started having doubts about, you know, how, you know, whether I really wanted to. And And it felt so sad to me because the impulse of generosity was so pure. And sometimes it's an act of generosity to receive someone's generosity. And to shut it down, to shut it off, is actually very ungenerous. I saw a hand over here before. Yeah.
Oh, I had a very similar story traveling in Mexico because there's women that are called vendedoras, and they set up just little grills, or they bring food from home, and you can just buy from them on the street.
Yeah.
And a friend and I were in a small town by the coast, and we saw this woman, and she had like a big, like, wok. And there were people gathered around, and she was cooking things, and there were people eating, and we're like, ooh, that smells so good. And we went over, and we were like, do you have this? Do you have fish? And, oh, yeah. And do you have some avocado? And, uh-huh. And people were handing us things, and we were eating. And so we got done with our meal, and we said, how much? And she said, nada. And what it was is this family had rented a bus. And they were traveling. And they had stopped at the park for a little bit. And that no one in that group, you know, there was maybe 10 people, looked at us or sent any kind of energy to us that made us feel unwelcome.
I love it.
We asked for, they gave us, oh, do you have some more onions? I thought that, you know, in the United States, if you went up to some people that were having a picnic, you know, people would look at you sideways, but I have experienced with people in Mexico very much that way too.
And
it was such a learning for us.
Beautiful,
that,
yeah.
That spirit of giving.
It's wonderful to go to cultures where there's generosity is so abundant. Remember when I was 17, I traveled to Greece, and the Greeks were so, at least to 17-year-olds, they were so generous to us. Boy, I couldn't believe it. We were dirt poor. We were the hippies, you know, kind of Volkswagen van and no money at all. We try to sell our blood so we can get some. But that proved hard. But you know, the same thing with picnic. I mean, people would invite us over to the picnics, and it was just, I was just blown away. And also, surprisingly enough, I don't know what it's like nowadays, but when I was 20, I traveled through Texas, and I was surprised how generous people were in Texas. I hadn't expected it. And because I had a certain reputation about Texas, but I don't know if, you know, I was really impressed. It was kind of, I had nothing like that had ever happened to me in L.A. Yeah?
Could you say something about generosity of justice?
No. not any better than you could. What do you want to say?
I just, you know, I don't have a sense of it, that's all. You know, just seems like a difficult concept for me.
Well, to be fair, for example, maybe, or help justice occur, you know, help justice in the world, support the movements for justice. Yes. Be just. Be a just person. Offer justice, I suppose, means to be a just person. Yes, Mita.
Once my husband and I were traveling to Sumatra, and at the end of 10-day travel, we were trying to locate an Indian restaurant because we kind of wanted familiar food. So it was in some old part of town, and directions were unclear. So there was a young woman who was going home clearly after work, and so we stopped her and asked her for directions, and she looked at us and said, "Where are you from?" And we said, "Well, we are basically originally from India." And she was so fascinated. She said she had never seen an Indian. She says, "You must come home." She says, "I want to take you home and show you to my brothers." And I was just so overcome, and I was so worried about this young woman. I said, "You know, don't say that to anybody else, though." So I said, "You know, there are all sorts of people." She said, "Don't worry, I have lots of brothers." This was the wonderful part. The sad part of it, I mentioned this story somewhere. A discussion came up in my book group. And the reaction to that was actually very sad. A lot of people thought it was somehow an offense to me, created an offense to me that somebody should impose themselves on me. And can imagine that I would actually want to go to their home. And it's just, I was so flabbergasted, I just didn't know what to say. It just made me very sad.
Yes, last one, and then maybe probably should stop.
Some of the body workers I know, giving and receiving to breath. So, inhaling, exhaling. And in fact, it's like asthmatics have trouble because they're afraid to let go of the breath. So they can't trust the thing that inhales. So there is, I'm just related to what you were saying about to receive is a gift. So, because you have to trust what's.
Yeah.
So sometimes I watch my breath that way. Like, am I.
Beautiful.
Where am I cat? You can change if you're watching to what you're.
So rather than concentrating on your breath or focusing on your breath, give and receive your attention at the breath. Your meditation might have a very different quality if you're offering your attention to your breath, receiving in awareness your breathing. So, thank you so much. I appreciate it all, and I'm grateful for being here. And I'll be back in 2 weeks.